Talk given Sunday, 14th March 1976. We may well ask ourselves, why is it that we find ourselves so shattered by death, which is a universal phenomenon? One may be born or one may not be born. There is no absolute certainty about that. But whatsoever is born and lives necessarily, inevitably dies. We hear of death in the distance. Somewhere somebody has died or been killed, perhaps brutally. We see animals dying, dead, and we contribute in the killing of animals in many parts of the world, deliberately killing them in one way or another. And although we are familiar with death in that way, it doesn't touch us as when an event of this type strikes right home. The intellect easily rationalizes about death in the vain belief and vain hope that it brings understanding and comfort, true comfort I'm talking of, to those who are bereaved, as we say. But the rationalization of the intellect is rejected by the heart, not because the rationalization is always or necessarily false, but because it is impotent. What makes it impotent? What is there in us ourselves which makes the stark unanswerability of death so hurtful, so terrifying, so unacceptable? This is a question we well might consider in conjunction with further questions. What is it that makes for our own imperfection, our own immaturity, I ask this because I want to suggest that if we were truly mature human beings, well integrated, better still, fully integrated human beings, then death or similar traumatic experiences would not shatter us. The truth of death is just this, that it is completely and totally interwoven with what we here call life. This is where our first error arises. We regard death as the opposite of life. This is a mistake. Life, eternal life, not merely continuous life in time, but eternal life, is the absolute fact which manifests itself as this alternation which we name birth, death, beginning, proceeding, ending. But we don't understand that when there is a beginning, life, the totality, the universal totality, restricts itself, precipitates itself out of its infinitude into manifestation as a particular finite being or object. Life deliberately, if I may use the word, imprisons itself into a finite manifestation. We human beings are specimens, some specimens, of that finite manifestation. And we human beings are conscious, self-conscious creatures who have the power to look within ourselves and be aware of that withinness in play with the what we call the external withoutness, with the environment. Now, although we see death, as something in terms of time, we don't understand that life in manifestation functions in terms of beginning, proceeding, ending, all in simultaneity. One may grasp this as a concept, but to be fully aware of this simultaneity, so that the intellect as well as our innermost mental sensitivity sees it as a matter of course. It is that which we lack. There is a time lag in our consciousness between birth, growth, and death. We are unable to be conscious in the immediate now of this extraordinary, discontinuous creative throb of life, this creative action in eternity. So the impress of this creative pulse comes to consciousness only long after it has taken place. There is a time lag. There is a sluggardliness in our mind and consciousness at work. Think, if we were conscious of birth and death as polar complementaries, so that death is the complete fulfillment and fruition of what we call birth, if we see that as being together in the immediate now, there would be no special room for pleasure at birth and for sorrow at death. But conscious in the manner in which we are, we experience joy at birth, one's own child particularly. And we are caught up in the fact, this is true for all of us, until there is utter wisdom and utter perfection, that we can hold and possess that which is born. And this is where our imperfection and our immaturity comes. This possessiveness, this wanting to hold, and this wanting to hold is actually a holding back. Do we not regret the emergence of the child, of the infant, out of its lovely cuddly state, as we call it, and so forth? We are seeking sensational delight for ourselves. And when we have adjusted ourselves to that, the child has meanwhile grown up, become an adolescent, and we are again regretful of that. And so on and so on. To hold and to possess and to keep for oneself, deluded and subject to the illusion that this means happiness. This is the root of sorrow, a root of sorrow. And then when the end comes, as we say, a death which is not the death which is the polar complementary of birth immediately here and now, but which is the complete disappearance of that living organism into the unknown, we are utterly shattered. If we have become attached to that organism, or also if we have experienced hate, terrible hate and resentment against that person. You see how the opposites are involved in all this. There's a terrible duality at work. What we call the opposites are complementary duals, but we never realize that complementariness because we desire to hold and to possess and to make things assume the shape we would like them to take, instead of being totally awake to the living process as such in the immediate now, without grasping at anything, and letting the life process go on utterly unobstructed by our desire or feeling. There is another thing. I said a few moments ago that to be born means that the infinite immeasurable, unknown, transcendent totality restricts itself, imprisons itself into a particular manifestation. But when that organism dies, really dies, that which was held in, bound, restricted, is released back into the transcendent, infinite, unknown perfection. And we weep. We are hurt when that release takes place. And in both cases, in connection with birth, as well as in connection with death, we experience sorrow. The temporary joy at birth and all the cares and problems and difficulties that are associated with the growth of the child and so on, the disappointments when the child does what we don't wish it to do, or suffers, or if the child suffers from some illness or pain or accident, etc., etc., we suffer, we are in sorrow. Pleasure ends in sorrow, and sorrow itself is of course sorrow and does not end in pleasure. We are unawake to reality and the nature of reality. We are unawake to the fact that we as living beings are divinity imprisoned. We are ignorant of the fact that when released out of this unawakenedness, either here now whilst we are living or when dead, by dying, there is a release into the absolute. The unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. Now, the awakening cannot take place merely by study, merely by the exercise of logical intellect. Logical intellect doesn't purify the soul. It facilitates, perhaps, the means, the way of purification. Logical intellect cannot enable our whole mind, our soul, if you like to so call it, so to feel the truth of things that we are that truth. Intellect sees the truth at a distance. It is separate from the truth. But this feeling aspect of the mind takes that truth into its own being and gives itself to that truth. The two take place together. When that is the case, then there are no tears, except the tears which can so wash the soul that the divine eye within oneself will see the whole light of the whole truth. So in that case, the tears are necessary. But there'll be no sorrow of the type that we experience in our ordinary everyday life. Our everyday life sorrow is the sense of loss, of deprivation, of personal hurt, as contrasted with the universal hurt which the universe itself suffers from. We are unawakened to that. We want to shut ourselves away from it. It is not hurt which is the problem. It is this abstracting ourselves out of the world as separate entities, as isolatively self-conscious creatures. We have to face that fact, that we are isolatively self-conscious. We are conscious of all our experience through our senses, through memory, through the mind, through our inspirations, in a separatist manner. I saw this, I heard that, I thought this, I had this inspiration. And in that enclosing I-ness, that selfness is the very root of all ill and misery for us human beings. It is this from which we have to free ourselves. One asks, how does one free oneself? Within ourselves, in actual fact, in terms of the eternal truth, we are free. Freedom is there. But freedom is not manifest, although it is present here now. It is not manifest because this psychophysical organism, through ignorance, first and foremost, and through its servitude to pleasurable sensation. This is the most important fact to bear in mind. Through its servitude to pleasurable sensation, is unable to be awake, to be conscious in its innermost depths of the truth of all things. And the truth of all things is embodied in oneself. Have not all the teachers, the spiritual teachers, and those with true vision, stressed the importance of self-knowledge? And this self-knowledge, this knowing oneself, is not an intellectualized structure expressed in terms of concepts and words. The concepts and words are mere signs to suggest, to indicate the reality. to feel that reality in its wholeness means that one has certainly begun to know. This is knowing by being that reality. Then there is an of course-ness about such knowledge. It functions in wholeness. That is to say, it functions not merely through the activity of the conscious mind or through merely accurate sense perception, but it functions through a mind that is utterly unified. That means that what we call the subconscious or unconscious and the conscious are no longer separate. There is only one total mind, wholly lighted up. The light is within. But in one who is not fully awakened, that light is so dim that there are still vast dark realms, unlightened. And in these dark realms, what we commonly call the unconscious, reside the impressions of all our life experience, and reside those drives which spring from the animal part of our nature, the physical body itself, which is derived from an animal ancestor, but which are devoid of the purity of those same drives in those animals which are other than man. Because in animals other than man, those drives are just the great energies of nature functioning in their own way. Animals have no capacity for looking within. And therefore, they are free from the complicated state into which we can get. They are just as complex as we are. The whole animal is also a psychophysical creature. Complex, wonderful, in harmony with the laws of its being, but devoid of the power of looking within itself, knowing itself, separating itself out from the environment, and then saying no to the laws of its being. Only you and I can do that. Therefore, we get complicated. The diseased condition. Don't we say, doesn't the doctor say that, oh, complications set in and the illness reached a climax and the man died finally? We are complicated, we are twisted up. We are, if I may use such an awful word, we have uglified ourselves, twisted up in the soul. So you see, when there is true vision, the mind sees as a whole. We can see the truth as God sees. Does that sound conceited? It sounds conceited, but that is the simple truth. God, insofar as that word represents the supreme, the perfect that man himself can realize, sees only through your eyes and my eyes. God, as understood, conceived, and finally realized by us. The transcendent comes to perfect realization of its own transcendence in human terms through you and me. And beyond that is the unknown, the everlastingly unknown and unknowable by man, as long as man is man, constituted as he is. So you see, you and I can see as God sees. Be careful, I have mentioned the limitation involved here. So, the necessity for purification. We have considered this time and again through the years. The simple moralities, the indispensable basis. Study the great religions of the world. I have been interested in such studies since I was a little child of 6, 7, 8 years of age onwards. So I've spent over 65 years in such study. And it's very little. I know nothing, next to nothing about it all. But one thing I have seen. Every single teacher, religious teacher, taught, laid emphasis upon the moralities. That is what he primarily taught. What else has he taught beside that? You'll find it very hard to get away from that. That is the fact. The simple fact. And our complicatedness, our twistedness, is concerned fundamentally with our unmorality. Is due to our unmorality. What is the common garden meaning of morality? Customary action. The mores of a people. Their customary procedure. And the customary procedure of a society has grown out of that society's perception and experience as to that way of life which best promotes the well-being of that society. So the moral codes of a society, whether in personal life, family life, business life, political life, whatever it is, all these moral codes are directed towards the well-being of society. But there is something else. Society is restricted in its vision and its understanding of the wholeness of existence. Very restricted. Because society consists of individuals who function as isolatively self-conscious persons. But one here, one there, wakes up out of that, breaks through the shell of ignorance, and becomes unselfed, And in that becoming unself realizes transcendence. And then at last, he knows, he sees the purpose of human existence at all, and the true meaning of human existence, and the fulfillment of human existence as something which is utterly transcendent and divine as compared with what fulfillment means for us good social beings who abide by the social moralities that we have brought into being. So they introduce the note of transcendent ethic, a transcendent morality. Look, how easily nations become utterly unmoral and ruthless. In our lifetime, we have seen incredible cruelty and horror, such subhuman bestiality. That the wildest beasts of prey in the world would shudder at. Only human beings, so-called, do that and can do that. It's happening now. It is spreading all over the world. So you see, this transcendent element is necessary. This transcendent element in ethic must triumph in order that the relative ethic by which we live no longer restricts us to reciprocity. I will be good provided you are good. I have to be good whatsoever you may do unto me. It is that transcendent morality which the great religions taught. And that is the way. The whole of the way is summed up in that. Other aspects involved with it we have considered again and again in different ways throughout these years. But don't leave it at an intellectual level, because then we are indulging ourselves like any other debauchee. We have to live it. We have to become the truth. Realize our full humanity. And then you will see death, the portal to eternity, as the great liberator, the perfecter, and the consummator.